Sherry Levitin and I have known each other for years, but only recently decided to start a podcast. But we both made a promise to each other, and that was to make a podcast different from any other podcast out there. It wasn't just going to be a podcast about sales or selling or marketing or even buying. We wanted a podcast about all of us, each of us as human beings, and how we connect with each other. And maybe some of those lessons poured over to sales at the end of the day. And in this episode of Selling Isn't Everything, we get into that. And I asked Sherry, you know, what are some of the life lessons that you've learned that you use every single day in sales? And I think as you hear the conversation, you'll agree, those are some lessons that you can use too. Enjoy the podcast. All right. Welcome everybody to what we're calling Selling Isn't Everything, what we think is going to be a podcast, Sherry, around sort of our life lessons from sales and how they extract out into sort of the world. And then also the lessons we've learned in life that apply in the sales. And we're on a journey. We've been on a journey for a while trying to put the show together and figure out what the right format is. You know, do we have guests? Do we not have guests? What are the specific topics? But one way or another, it just seems like every time you and I get together, we have these just really great, rich, interesting conversations given our both experience, but also kind of diverse perspectives and experience as well.
It's been 2 years, Brent, just to put it into context. So we have been talking about doing this for 2 years. We like different titles, different formats, and then we got busy. And then, you know, and I don't know if it's perfectionism, procrastination, or just wanting to get it right.
Maybe, or, you know, well, it's funny you say it, because I was raised by a mom who taught me that perfection is barely good enough. And that has always been a bit of a hamstringing effect on me, but it's never led to therapy, but probably should have. But the because I would have to be perfect in therapy and nobody needs that. But anyway, so one of the things, Sherry, that so the thing that's so where the name comes from, Selling Isn't Everything, is our kind of mutual deep belief, right, in B2B selling, that selling is more just an instance, an example of not just selling interactions, but human interactions. And the more that we can understand those human interactions and how not, you know, sales tactics integrate with buying tactics, but how people just interact with each other in an effective manner. But the cool thing is, I think, one, you and I both deeply believe one will get better at selling. I think we also, though, deeply believe just have better relationships and just a better, just get more quality out of your experiences, your relationships as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've always believed, and I told you this when we first met, I think we were at a Gartner event, and I was sort of, I don't know if there's a word fanboying you, but we were at a Gartner event. We were walking along the bridge in DC, and I remember saying to you that I believe better people make better salespeople, not the other way around. And, you know, there's so many sellers out there, whether it's B2B or B2C, quite frankly, because we do have some B2C clients and it's the same, but different. But I do believe that, you know, so many sellers are looking for a magic bullet, a magic tactic, or, you know, some kind of hack, which I hate that word, the hack. But the truth is that you've got to become a better human to become a better salesperson. Because if you think about what we're doing, it's listening skills. It's being truly curious. It's taking responsibility, accountability. It's being on this path of discipline and continual learning and having to reinvent ourselves and all of these things that really aren't just sales lessons. They're life lessons. And I think that's how the title was born, that selling isn't everything, but it's something, right?
But it is something. Just to be clear, Sherry, the way you just put that, if you're struggling at sales or you're quote unquote bad at sales, does that mean you're a bad human?
Oh God, now you're messing with me. No, it does not mean that, you know, the inverse is not true. I know you're very...
All right, I just want to make sure we're not saying that.
These debates, you being a linguist are going to challenge me. But no, the inverse is not true. Because I do believe, I don't believe anybody can sell. My husband would be a terrible salesperson. He is so literal.
Oh, interesting.
He's scientific. Yeah. He's, you know, very much an analytical. He's a pilot. He's a doctor. He just doesn't want to talk to people that much. He was an anesthesiologist. He put people to sleep if they talk too much. So, but I don't believe that anyone can sell, but I believe anyone who wants to can be a good human. But no, the inverse.
There you go.
Is not true.
All right. Okay. So these are some of these ideas that I think you and I both just find super interesting to kind of geek out on. And we've got a long list of potential guests that we've lined up in our heads, at least, of who could come in and kind of share their perspective on this. But maybe to kick us off, so I'd asked you a question the other well, it was not the other day now, it was a while ago, but we've kind of reviewed it a couple times around this. It seems like an interesting thing to talk about, given where we are in our profession, which is more advanced, which is code for old. But this question of like, there's all sorts of lessons I think that we can take from selling and our experience selling, or my experience of being involved in sales and researching sales and being around the sales profession for the better part of 3 decades now almost. What are some of the things you learned about selling that are, you know, life lessons? So selling lessons that have become life lessons, I think would be an interesting place to start the conversation. And I know you've had a long list. We won't get through them all today, but are there a couple that stand out for you?
Yeah. I wrote a few things down, and I was actually, as I was preparing for this morning, I had to stop and sometimes you have to
Were we supposed to prepare? Oh God.
Well, not really. And we talked about that because God. Otherwise it gets performative, right? And you know, I would have a tendency to over prepare and that's not a good thing when speaking from the heart. So I really just stopped and brought myself back 35 years.
Which, by the way, there's your first life lesson. Don't over-prepare in life and probably don't over-prepare for sales. But let's
need to over-prepare. Yeah. I might object on that. But I guess I was thinking about, you know, what are those things that I learned early on that I've mm-hmm. taken with me, knowing that just because I may have penciled out or thought of 7 to 10 great life lessons and I want to share them with our audience doesn't mean I always do them. And I think I just want to start there because I think having a distinction for a lesson or having a distinction for how we should be is the starting point. It's sort of like, you have to admit you're an alcoholic before you can cure it. Like, you have to admit that these lessons are just lessons and they're a North Star, but we're human. And we're
I've learned, for example, that eating 2 large pizzas within a 20-minute span is a bad idea, but I still do it, right?
That second glass of wine or last night, I did not have the second paper plane at the restaurant. And I love a paper plane. I don't know what's in it. Don't tell me. I don't care. But it was really...
What is a paper plane? Is that a drink?
It's a drink. But I don't know what's in it.
I didn't know that.
Okay. In Utah, there
is. Okay, I want to ask.
Anyway, one of the first biggest lessons I learned from my mentor, and I've had some wonderful mentors, male and female. This particular mentor, my first real mentor in sales, always said to me, Sherry, you can lose the deal, but don't lose the lesson. And that to me, Brent, has so many implications. And then I want to hear your view. And I'll just share really quickly what that meant to me. He used to say to me, there's 3 goals of any sales conversation. Number 1, make the customer feel better about you and your company after the conversation than before. Of course, back then we were meeting people face to face. Today, you know, if you upset a customer, they're not going to tell 10 people, they're going to tweet it to 10,000 or 10 million. So obviously, keeping that brand and keeping that relationship is key. He said the second goal of any sales conversation is to make the sale, that being the second goal. But he said the third one is what will make you wealthy. If you didn't get the deal, try to understand why. The real reason, not the made-up ego reason, like they didn't have enough money or they didn't have budget or the timing wasn't right. Like the real reason, look deep, learn from it, and don't make that mistake again. And to further that, when you lose a deal or anything in life, when we lose a relationship, when we lose a dog, I mean, life is hard. And when we lose, yes, we want to mourn, but we want to mourn quickly. And I found a quote. I don't know if you listened to Federer's commencement speech. It was pretty iconic. He said something that the tennis player...
Okay. Graduated, huh?
Not the senator, not Fetterman, the tennis player. I love this line. Roger Federer said, when you lose every second point on average, you learn not to dwell on every shot. When it's behind you, it's behind you.
Truth. It's like baseball, right? I mean, even the best batting averages are often below 40%, right? Or 400. So that's a great point.
I mean, how does that sit with you? Like when you lose... Do you mourn? Do you like get depressed forever? Are you able to move on?
Remember mom, right? Who taught me perfection's barely good enough. So I do everything and I operate always from, as you know, a position of deep self-hatred. So there's always, that's kind of always on for me, right? So the, the beating myself up isn't like, oh, I made a mistake, I beat myself up, or I need to beat myself up, because I'm already doing that anyway. So it's, I suppose there's an incremental sort of self, you know, sort of doubt that comes. But I agree with you that learning from it, like, here's, but let me throw out a caveat and get your reaction to this, because the way, I don't know if that's what you meant to, but the way you articulated that at least implied to me that somehow if something goes wrong, it is on you, either an error of omission or commission. Either you did something or didn't do something that you can learn from, say, next time I'm going to do this or don't do this. But sometimes when you get dumped in a relationship or a customer doesn't buy from you or whatever, or your dog dies, so I think is what you mentioned, maybe it's not on anything you did or didn't do at all. Do you know what I mean? And that to me is actually what's really, which is not to say you can't learn from that. I think you can actually learn a lot from that and say, oh, I see how this happened. I would have never thought to either do something or not do something here. But next time I know now to try something I've never even thought to try before. I think that's in the scope of what you're suggesting. Is that because it's not always you screwing up or by either doing something or not doing something. Is that fair?
Yes and no. Our friend Beck Holland said something once that really affected me. She's so wise, very wise beyond her years. And, you know, she said, I guess it depends. Dog die? Yeah. I mean, the dog's going to die. Yeah, you know, we're all going to die. The dog's going to die. It's a horrible thing.
But if you forgot to feed it,
you might want to look at that, right?
Like that is on you, right?
Right. Sorry, right. My dog's listening to this conversation and she's twitching.
Poor dog. So that's,
my little Mia does not like this conversation, but the dog's going to die. But Beck said something and I really thought it was brilliant. She said, look, if you look at something that happens at work, you get fired or there's an argument with a spouse or whatever. And I don't know where she got this. She says, if we even look at, because there's such an opportunity to have victim mentality, and I hate victim mentality. And even if we say, I'm so mad at this person, they really screwed me over. If we can stop and say, did I have 10% involvement in that? Did I create that maybe a little bit? Was I a little bit? And that is where we get our power. Because when we can start to say, how did I contribute to that? And to be honest, sometimes it'll take me a year of being mad at something or gosh, you know, that wasn't fair. But I think that there is incredible power in learning to take responsibility. And without it, we can never be truly successful. I always say we can't take the glory for being great if we won't take the responsibility when we're not. What could we have done better?
So you and I are totally aligned with this, which is my suggestion wasn't necessarily like something goes wrong, goes bad, goes south, you fail. And just like find all the ways you possibly can to blame others. So I think there's absolutely an opportunity to reflect and say, what could I have done differently? What should I have done differently? What could I do differently going forward? But that's, to me, is slightly different question of than the question of what did I do wrong, right? Which is, it's kind of your Federer point, which is what did I do wrong is a retroactive perspective. What could I do differently is a proactive perspective, right? Which I think is exactly what you're saying, which is, so just like, don't fall into the trap of victim, which I think is also retroactive. They did this. So notice that's all past tense. They did this to me. They said this. Or the beat yourself up. I did this. All of that is tensed grammatically in the past tense versus next time I could do this or next time because they did this, I need to watch out for that. Next time I'm going to do this as a result to try to better manage the situation or avoid it or whatever it might be. It's really interesting to kind of tease this out because the lesson you put on the table, I think, is spot on. It's just really interesting to think about sort of the subtleties of it, which is where do I have agency here? What are the things that I can control? What are the things that I can influence? And going forward, how can I show up? How can I behave, interact differently such that this situation doesn't happen again? Like maybe I should feed the dog, right?
Right. And I think, exactly. Yeah. One of the tactical strategies he gave me, which I love, is he said, in your life, change the pronoun. Now, not like how we discuss pronouns today. But this idea that he said, don't ever say they didn't have the budget. I didn't show them the value. Don't ever say, they said the timing wasn't good. I didn't create enough urgency. And he used to say, if you change the pronoun, you'll change your life. And, I think there's some truth to that. And when I go into organizations, and I'm sure when you go into organizations, you can tell a lot about a culture. Are people willing to take responsibility? And it goes a step further. Are they willing to own it as a culture? And that comes from the top down, I believe. And I'm very curious what you think, because you work with huge organizations. You're working with VPs, CROs. And I believe it's a, it starts from the top up, from the culture, from the head of the org. Do they freak out when people make mistakes? Do they shame them? Or do they say, well, it's just like skiing. If you don't, you know, you don't fall down, you're not skiing hard enough. What's your experience of that? Is it something cultural?
Well, you know, it's funny. This is a pretty deep conversation I had a couple of weeks ago, and I don't remember, it might have been with Matt Hines, but there's something about this I've found really interesting over, you know, the 25 or so years I was a corporate executive working at Gartner, and, you know, still today working with organizations around the world. But particularly when we rolled out Challenger, the Challenger sale, and organizations, you know, all over the world adopted Challenger and made it their methodology and spent years and sometimes hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars investing in this. And many of them had great, great success watching them have just heard, like, you know, I'll never forget when the sales organization showed up, their sales kickoff, and the head of sales is a guy named Pat, who's since retired, but he came up, he's about 3 years into their Challenger journey, and he saw me coming down the hall. He says, Brent, I got great news. I said, Pat, it's so good to see you. He said, yeah, I know, I got to tell you this. I said, well, what's up? He said, I got great news. I said, what's that? And he said, this Challenger thing. I said, yeah, what about it? He says, it actually works. and it was really funny is he'd been going on faith effectively for 2.5 years until he could actually get the bar charts and the graphs that show that they now have demonstrated success as a result of this. But here's what's interesting, and that kind of picking up on the point you said about individual culture and executive leadership, is when Pat retired from this company a couple of years later, it just all just almost vanished overnight. And I think this isn't a story about Challenger. It's a story about direction and culture, right? Which is, you know, whether it's an idea, it's a tool, whether some of the work that you've done with amazing companies around the world, right? Or it's so interesting to me how one person leaves.
Yes.
And the whole thing is almost, it's not even like crumbles. It's like gone. It's just vanished like vapor. And it's like, I think there's interesting dynamics about the new person has to come in and put their stamp on things. But you just think, like, what just happened for the last 4 years of investment? Why, where did it go? And there's individual sellers left there thinking, What was that? What about that thing that we've been doing for 4 years? But so all of that that's a really long way to say, I totally agree with you. I think so much of organizational culture, so much of organizational thinking, and I guess in this point, process execution and expertise comes from the very top of the function or very top of the company. And I never really appreciated until I got into this world of business 20 years ago, how individual dependent that was.
It really is. And I think that it kind of comes full circle. These life principles that we're talking about, these universal principles, are they being adopted at the top? Which leads me to, I'd love you to throw one out as we're sort of in the middle of this podcast together. What's one life lesson that you've learned that you've really taken on into the rest of your life?
So this picks up on something you said earlier about, you know, about victimizing and blaming and self-blame, all the things we was talking about. But there's something I found very productive. I learned this from as a head of sales who's since become a dear friend of mine who's now retired. It's a guy named Adrian Norton. And Adrian was among other companies at a company called Reckitt Benckiser. A drug company. They had a set of values, just like a lot of companies will have, you know, sort of their corporate values. And Adrian was led the charge of like rolling out the corporate values for his team. And what they did is that, like some companies do, they named their conference room after a different value. So each conference room you go have a meeting in was named after values. Kind of cool. But it's not that he did that, because a lot of people do that. It's the value that he chose. And something he taught me as a lesson, because he's a bit of a mentor for me and a coach and just a good dear friend. And the value that stuck with me all these years was assume that others are working with good intentions.
And
that was really, really interesting. By the way, I've put this out on LinkedIn and different posts and talked about it in different places. And I've had people come at me, say, like, you're going to be a victim. You're going to get rolled over. You're going to get crushed. And particularly, I think in today's environment, political environment, there's like, you're a patsy or weak if you assume this kind of perspective, because you're just going to get steamrolled. I think there's enough good in the world, and there's enough good, at least in me, left to think that I'd like to go through life and go through my life and my world, assuming, test and verify, as the saying goes, right? But the nonetheless, I like to, at least my starting point is that we're all human beings, that we're all trying to do the best we can, we're all struggling with something, and we're all trying to work with good intentions. Now, what you consider to be a good intention, what I consider to be a good intention, may be different. But actually, if you go up a level to like good intentions, like we may define intentions differently, and we can have a conversation about that. But let's, because I think this is a way for us to bridge gaps even today in the political polarization that we're in. Because if you look at the far left and the far right, freaking not to get super political even on our first episode, but what you find when you scratch the surface of what feel like diametrically opposed views, you find the exact same desire of
safety. We're not that different. That's so true.
Right? We're all looking for safety. We're looking for affirmation. We're looking for reassurance.
Belonging.
Belonging. These are things we all have in common. They just manifest in radically different ways. And I learned this not so much through politics today. You learn this in like conference rooms where the deal goes south and procurement gets involved and something blows up and the customer looks at you and says, this isn't going to work. And you either blame yourself or you blame them or they're incompetent or they had a bad leadership or whatever. And you realize, no, we're all just people just trying to get through life. We're all just a bunch of schlubs. I tell people all the time, I'm just a schlub from Omaha, you know, and that's okay.
No, I love what you said, Brent. You've got to start with good intentions. I talk about that in my book, actually, in chapter 5. And I talk about that, you know, as salespeople particularly, and as humans, it's not only starting with trust, it's looking for the good. You know, we're looking for the good in people. And this is, of course, a huge, important management principle. You know, if I look for the good in someone and then I bring it out and let them feel it, usually they don't disappoint you. It's having belief in humans. And something that was interesting, I don't know if you remember this. This was years ago. My brother, who you've obviously talked to, big in the music industry, told me a great example of this. Do you remember, you know, when music started going digital? And everybody started, you know, recording and ripping digital music. And the music industry was just freaking out, right? Like, oh my God, what are we going to do? How are we going to preserve this? We can't trust anybody. They're going to steal our stuff. Yeah. And there's a really interesting example. Do you remember the band Radiohead?
Yeah.
By any chance you do? I didn't really listen to them, but it wasn't really my genre. I think they were a little alternative. They're okay. During this time when everybody was freaking out, not trusting anybody, and all these signs at concerts will be prosecuted, you know, if we record this and all this, Radiohead took a different tack. They took their album, Imagining Myself, In Rainbows, put it up online, said, here's our new music, donate what you think it's worth. And they reportedly made more money on that than they ever had until then. Again, they believed that people had good intentions. And it flipped this no trust narrative on its head. And I believe for sure in sales, if you start a call and you think, I'm not sure they qualify, you know, I'm not sure, you know, this whole BANT thing, it's like, wait a minute, like, let's get to know them. Let's hear what they have to say. Let's assume that they have good intentions. Let's assume they're not trying to screw me in this negotiation. Rather than, you know, making comments, let's ask questions, which is another principle I believe with all my heart, that anything that can be told can be asked. Don't make accusations. Ask questions. Be curious. Get to know people. And so I love what you say. And yet it's not always easy, because I do find myself sometimes, after being burned in a certain area, depending on the day, depending how I'm feeling, I go, you know, I don't know. Like, how do you always keep?
Well, I think it's not. Well, I don't. God knows I don't. Ask my wife, right? But I refer to her as my better two thirds, by the way. But and then I'm rounding down when I say that. It's much more. The reason why all this is hard and confusing and fraught is because at the end of the day, we're not selling, we're interacting with other human beings, right? Like, selling is just a moment, it's a context for human interaction. And what's hard about selling isn't selling, it's interacting with other people, because we're all complex, we're all confused, we're all sort of trying to figure it out, and we're all operating in multiple layers of context simultaneously, right? It's like I'm trying to do this deal with you while I'm also worried about my daughter getting into college, or, you know, or the dog barfed on the rug behind me and off camera. That didn't
just
happen.
You're back to the dog.
It's always the dog. There's so many of these kinds of themes I think we could explore and hopefully inspire people or just get them thinking, and we'll lean into different tactics, that because I know a lot of what you do in your training and your books and is really leaning hard into, like, okay, given these ideas, what do we do about them? And this is where I've landed in my work. As you know, I'm now independent. I've written a book coming out in September called The Framemaking Sale. And the reason why I bring this up is because it takes me back to something you said that your boss said to you. It's called all the way back to the beginning conversation. Like, you kind of have three objectives in a conversation. One was to make the customer feel better about you, your company, your product. The second one was, tell me what the other two are, just because I'm so focused.
Well, then the second one is to get the sale. And then the third one, he said, we'll make you rich, successful, whatever they said back in the 80s.
Here's a fourth, which I would argue is the first, because it opens the door for all of those other things. It opens the door for their perception of you. It opens the door for you making the sale. It opens the door for you making more money, which is, how can I interact with a customer such that I'm not so much focused on changing the way they think about me, but how do I interact with a customer such that I'm focused on changing the way they think about themselves? And this to me feels like such an unlock for selling and for dating and for personal relationships and for friendships. It is a lesson that I learned way back when as a child. I don't know where I picked this up, but someone said the best thing you could do to make friends in your life is to get them talking about themselves. And this is just a manifestation of this bigger idea, which is, how can I interact with someone in such a way through, maybe it's through questions, maybe it's through coaching, maybe it's through guidance, but how can I not make them feel better about me and my expertise and my ability to be a thought leader, trust advisor, but how can I interact with them in such a way that they feel more confident in themselves and their ability to make a good decision, whether it's on behalf of their company and purchasing a CRM system, or whether it's choosing better dog food.
Yeah, no, I love that. And it's so true. And I think we forget that. And we get so focused on, I got to get this deal. It's this, it's that. And you know, this is, you know, some of this wisdom is age old wisdom, right? It's you could be Eastern philosophy. It could be, you know, Plato and Aristotle. But really, you know, Maya Angelou, you know, people never forget what you say. People forget what you say. They never forget how you make them feel.
Make them feel. Yeah.
And it's all about the emotion. And as you said, it's all about how they feel about themselves. And in this day and age, then when we want to get more technical and into complex B2B sales, you know, when we did that event for Microsoft together, you know, when we put together this course called Command the Account, really today, I think one of the things you said that was so brilliant is it's not about giving customers confidence in us. It's about giving them confidence in their own ability to decide. Because today we are a world where products are so complex, and we've got information overload. It's so hard to make choices. It's really about giving them confidence. And so it opens up the question of, how do we help to give people confidence? How do we help them to feel good about themselves? And I think you're right. I think if that's the beginning of the focus, I used to say to my son, who's now 20, when he first started dating and he was 14 and he's very smart, takes after his father, trying to be very competent and to show all that he knows. And I just said, Tyler, be interested, not interesting. And then compliment their shoes.
Nice shoes. You've got, I'm sure whatever you're wearing today, they're awesome. You're rocking some amazing shoes.
They're amazing, Brent. That they might be.
Aren't they? Oh, your toes. Your toes are already made an appearance.
It's summer. Can you do this? Can you do this yoga pose?
Is that a yoga pose? Or is that just a...
Yeah, it's definitely.
We're off the rails.
We're off the rails. It might be time to ask the question, Brent.
Yeah.
Selling isn't everything. Or is it something? But is it something?
Well, it is absolutely. Selling is an example of interacting with other people, right? And the more we can focus on that, I think particularly going forward, in a world where we're using AI to offload all the, boring or repetitive activities, thus freeing up humans for higher value activities, it really begs a question, like, what is a higher value activity? What does that even mean, right?
Wait, does that mean I'm going to doom more on Instagram? Because that doesn't help.
Well, it turns out the answer for me is yes, unfortunately, but that's yet another episode. But when you get into these messy human interactions that we've just explored for the better part of, 30 minutes now or so, when we've turned that into workshops and training in the book and all that kind of stuff and keynotes. And I was just on a call with a very large company earlier this week. We're kind of walking through some of that. And one of their leaders on the call rightly said, he said, wow, what you're laying out is absolutely right. We buy it. He's totally bought in. He says, this is really hard. And I said, I don't know what my people are going to say about this. This is really, really hard. And my reaction is kind of like, yeah, because AI is coming for the easy stuff. One. And two, if you think selling is hard, the reason why you think selling is hard is because buying is hard. And if you don't want to deal with all this mess of like multiple stakeholders and building consensus and getting them involved with each other and getting them to agree on these things, that's too hard. I don't want to do that. Well, now you're leaving your customers thinking the same thing. That's too hard. I don't want to do that either. And that's what I think so the life lesson that I bring to the table to sum all this up is we have to run right at hard things. Every time in my life and in my career, I've run away from the hard thing. I've gotten burned and I've gotten burned badly. And we have to, in sales and in life, I think, figure out what are those things that scare us that feel like, oh God, I don't want to do that. And sometimes you have to go doom scroll for a couple hours, but then we got to get up, got to get out of bed. We got to find the hard thing that's worth fighting for. And we got to go do the hard thing.
Right.
And
I love that.
I think what we got to explore in this podcast.
I love that.
How do we do the hard things? Yeah.
No, you're so right. One more quick anecdote along with that. I got to do a series of trainings for the military, which was a huge honor.
Super cool.
It was one of the few times I got up on a stage and I just wept. Because to me, of all the big stages I've been on all the sales kickoffs, there was nothing more meaningful to me. And I felt like I was serving my country, and it just felt like the biggest honor. And of course, my mother being a Holocaust survivor, if it wasn't for the U.S. military, I probably wouldn't be here today. But something stuck with me that I'll never forget. One of the soldiers, I was talking to the recruitment division, came up to me, good-looking kid, really built. Of course, he's in the military. And we were teaching.
You were a little distracted, admit it, weren't you?
Yeah, I was a little distracted, admittedly. I was very Brad Pitt-like back in the day. And thank you for that, Brent. Thank you for that image. But anyway, he said something really interesting. We were doing, multiple day workshop on, recruiting and prospecting and of course it got into, rejection and discovery and all of these things. And he said something to me. He says, I got to tell you, I was on the front lines of Afghanistan. And he said, and that was nothing compared to how hard it is to hear no from a new recruit. He says, that bothers me more. It's more painful for me to hear the word no than to be on the front lines. And you think about that. You think about going for hard. And here are the men and women that are serving our country. They're doing the hardest thing a human being can do. And yet he found sales and rejection even harder. So yeah. I love that. And I think that is a wonderful place to leave for now.
I think it's because selling isn't everything, but it is something, and it's hard. And when you get rejected in sales, it feels like you're getting rejected, right? And that's I think we're going all the way back to the beginning is your lesson around, what can I take away from this? And the one thing you take away from this is I can do differently. I can do better going forward, but this is not a rejection of me. That's so much to explore, Sherry. This is going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait to go on this journey with you. As much as we've talked about it, I think we've kind of figured out sort of what this could be and what it could be about. I would encourage to the degree, once we get this out there in the world, for people to just reach out to us and suggest, could you guys talk about this? Or could you share this? Or like, what's resonating? Or what challenge are you facing that you'd like us to blather on about for 30 minutes and share stories on? It'd be super interesting. Awesome. Sherry.
Thanks, Brent.
Episode 1. Thank you.